You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins. Welcome back for part two of my conversation with Katori Hall. If you're enjoying, please visit me at bpn.com/youcan'tsaythat.
I've been in the sand. My head been in the sand.
Right. So let's talk about Tina.
Tina. Rolling. Rolling.
I don't know how she ever kept up that much energy. Now, that's some energy, too. Miss Tina and Miss Adrienne Warren just killing it.
I don't know how she does it.
Just moving and talking. Just like, woof.
I don't know how she does it.
She's amazing.
She is phenomenal. So blessed. Mm-hmm. It's crazy how we even, how she even became part of the project. I remember I had written the first draft, had kind of reconstructed everything, and we did a roundtable at Stage Entertainment, the company that ended up producing it. And I had seen her in Shuffle Along. I don't even know if I had seen her in Shuffle Along yet. But someone was like, you should, bring Adrienne Warren in. I was like, okay. Hunty, she came in 10 a.m. Hunty, their throat at 10 a.m. was on fire. It was crazy. And we didn't say, oh, learn the Tina songs, and we were just going to read the book, right? She came in. She knew Private Dancer. We was ready for Rolling on the River.
Oh,
it was like, I was like, so we ain't got to have auditions right for this part, right? Right. It was crazy. And I think when people see Adrienne, they're like, oh, she's kind of tiny. Like, can she, really play Tina? Like, there's a meatiness about Tina. And, Tina's very wide in the world. But, she's just such a great actress. And what's beautiful about Adrienne is that there's dramaturgy, even with how she puts together the voice of Tina over mm-hmm. the course of the night, mm-hmm. where she kind of begins in a, I wouldn't say genteel place, but, kind of solid, and there's a wail in her voice, but she just, adds the rasp, and then she adds this particular vibrato, and then she, it's crazy, and so you actually see Tina Turner forming mm-hmm. in front of your very eyes by just the way that she approaches vocal technique.
Yeah.
It's funny, obviously I follow her on Instagram, and she actually can mimic a lot of, styles. Like, she does her Britney Spears.
Wow.
Yeah, she has a really good Britney Spears. Like, you turn your head and you're like, wait a minute. And you're like, oh my God, it's Adrienne. Like, just a phenomenal talent.
Wow. Yeah. No, she's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
She's amazing. And then I went to see Shuffle Along after I heard that 10 a.m. throat, and I was like, wow, she can kind of do anything.
I thought she was amazing in Shuffle Along. And if you saw Shuffle Along early, she played two different characters
mm-hmm.
who were, you saw it early. So when she had those two different characters, because by the end, she only had that one character.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Why'd they do that?
Story, I don't know. But she played just wildly different characters.
Wildly.
That was amazing.
Her range.
Yeah.
She can do anything.
Yeah, she really can.
So I'm so excited about her future. And Tina's big, right? What's happening in her life right now with that show, it's just monumental.
Like, for who?
For Adrienne.
Okay.
In terms of just the press, and you're seeing her on Colbert now. But I'm like, this is just the beginning for you. Like, I cannot wait to see what else. Like, you will do a bigger part than this, even though this is a big part. But what you have inside of you.
Who's bigger than Tina? Come on.
I'm just saying, in terms of, there's something.
I'm thinking,
is it Beyonce? She gonna play Beyonce? Beyonce probably ain't even bigger than Tina.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't know who else who's bigger. Like, what's bigger?
What I mean by that is, because theater is transient,
something
right?
The finding something that can expand your capacity becomes the challenge for you as an artist. Like, after you've been this big, what else can you do?
Like,
everything else is too small.
It's interesting. I was reading an interview she just did. She's interested in directing and producing. And I'm like, well, that is being bigger.
Right. Exactly.
Way. Yeah.
Right.
So
expanding into other areas. Because
yeah.
I think that there's that thing that you get to be that big. And certainly for me, that's why I'm writing and directing, because mm-hmm. it's like, okay, what more can I do as an actress that I haven't already done in 40 years, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what else have you got coming up? What's next?
What else do I got coming up?
More babies?
No. No. I was like, husband, get out of there. What I got next? Oh, I have a play at the Signature Theater where we first met and worked together on Hurt Village. I'm doing a new play called The Hot Wing King.
Is that still part of your residency?
Yes, part of my residency. My 5-year residency, which is taking me 8 years to finish.
Okay.
Because of them babies.
Okay.
So I just started reworking certain sections. We did we just finished auditions, and I'm so proud of the play, and I'm so excited to get into the rehearsal room again and to be back in theater and not commercial theater is its own kind of beast, but to just be in a room where it's just all about the words and all about, the community and just making everything sing where you have complete and total control. Like, it's not about, producers whispering in your ear, change this, change that. It's you, particularly at that theater where it's a writer's theater. So
let's talk about that residency, because I know that there's challenges to that residency.
Yes.
Like you get locked in and you have a contract and you get health insurance, but then you can't do other work.
It's interesting. So I feel as though I probably got the short end of the stick on that compared to other playwrights. And what I mean by that is I got in around 2011, 2012. And so I had only produced one other play in New York by that time. And so because I locked myself into Signature, I wasn't able to kind of spread my plays around versus someone like Dominique or Brandon, who...
Well, I think Brandon felt the same way.
Really? It's funny. You think the grass is greener on the other side.
Right. No. For him, it was because he wanted to do My Mother Courage, and they wouldn't let him out, even to do an adaptation.
Oh, that's crazy.
They wouldn't let him out. They would allow him to do an adaptation.
Was Jim alive then?
Jim was alive, and they would not let him do... I mean, Jim was not well, but they would not let him do an adaptation because of his Signature residency contract. Because,
I had fights about, certain pieces that I wanted done. And because I was like, you ain't going to do them. So, if you don't do it, then who's going to do it?
Right.
That you should let other people do it if you pass on a play.
Right. So and the fact is, during that 5 years when you're getting produced, that's when everybody wants to see you and you're hot. And by the time the 5 years are up, there's a new crop coming in. So,
Yeah.
It's a great thing to have that security. But at the same time, it's the window when the opportunities are big for you.
Yeah. But I will say, I haven't really worked at that many theaters, so I really can't speak too much to this. But I just don't know where, as a writer, you have that much support and control over your work. I've had readings at the Public, and you get these ream of notes, or you don't get any notes at all, which is a whole nother conversation. I've had readings at Atlantic, and there's always, I think when you have a reading or developmental reading at a space, there's this expectation that you need to change your play for that space. Mm. And Signature is so anti that. They're like, your play is your play. I would ask for notes. I'm like, Jim, give me notes. Oh, you just need to see your play. Like, you are so in control of your process. You're in control of how it's marketed. You're in control of how it's talked about. Like, they are constantly pulling you into meetings. Like, damn, do I need to be at this meeting? Shit. Do I need to be at the set design meeting? I'm like, actually, I do. And, I think it's very empowering for a playwright to be able to just be asked, your opinion on things that you think you shouldn't have an opinion about, but you actually do, because it is the work is emanating from you. And I actually think working at a place like Signature can prepare you to become a showrunner for a TV show because of all those meetings that you are in, and because everything you gain the confidence to be your own spokesperson for your own work.
Mm-hmm.
So
how did you navigate Tina? Because that's a play in New York and you're still under a residency.
So my very smart agent at the time, Olivier Sultan, basically put in my contract, if it's a commercial production, you guys can't touch it.
Got it.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah.
Good foresight.
Very good foresight. He was like, anything commercial? Nah, baby. And I also think Jim and the theater at the time kind of understood, like, there's just such a difference. Like, I think about the amount of money that I made on Our Lady of Cabejo. It was $16,000, right? I don't even know how much money I'd have made off of Tina because I ain't had time to count it all.
Okay.
So okay. It's
that. We like that.
We love that.
Okay.
And we love that. We love that having children being fed. We love having possibly, you know, an opportunity.
A legacy. Annuity.
Absolutely. So, and that's the dance you have to do when you're, you know, I think Off-Broadway is probably the place where the most pure, if you can say that, put that in air quotes, form of theater is being done. But then I do think you can get satisfaction and artistic satisfaction on the commercial, on the Great White Way. I do think you can. You just have to find the right producers. Yeah. So
you're going to tell us what's next?
After
the play.
After the play. I'm going to try to chill the fuck out. Okay. Because I have been producing like a crazy person. I am so full and I am so passionate about, you know, storytelling. Mm-hmm. But I think George Wolfe said something interesting. He was like, you need time to be stupid. Mm-hmm. You just need time to be in your house to, you know, look at the Kardashians if you fucking want to. You just mm-hmm. need to be able to do it. Mm. So that your mind can start connecting newer ideas and connecting it to, you know, things that you've always wanted to say, but you haven't found the right story. Like, I think as writers, as creators, we're always creating, and that time to just kind of sit back and incubate things.
Yeah, synthesis happens, and things start configuring in different ways that they couldn't if you were working all the time.
Exactly.
This is the question I wanted to ask you. Mm. You're a powerful woman, strong, talented. You've got a husband.
I do. I
failed at that.
How am I doing that?
Exactly. I failed at that. Did you think it's because he's not American?
No, I think it's because there's lots of sex.
I wish that sex was the only thing you needed.
I know. Love is not enough.
I would do lots of sex. That's Disney.
Love is not enough.
Sex
is not enough. I feel as though there is great understanding and empathy. He is just a very special person. Whether I found him in Uganda, Antarctica, on the moon, he is a special person. And I feel so blessed that I have had such a support in him. I know that it's rare. And so I do not take it for...
But what about before him?
I was out here in these streets, you know, doing things and trying to figure out.
Did you ever have challenges with men having a problem with the fact that you're so powerful?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
What was that like?
Especially because I was always dating actors who wanted roles in my show. And then they would get mad when I wouldn't cast them because they weren't good enough. So horrible.
Oh, yeah.
They shall remain nameless.
Oh. Yeah, I kept imagining maybe it's a European man. Maybe European men or African men are accustomed to powerful women in a way. Because
he has grown up with a lot of powerful women in his life. And so I think having seen that and honoring that probably does allow him to love someone who... you know, can be selfish sometimes because, unfortunately, I have to be in order to do all the things that I have to do.
How do you schedule that day? I mean, you've got a lot going on.
I have a really great assistant, my dear Ian, and learning how to say no.
Okay.
Yeah, I only do things I want to do.
Well, thank you for saying yes
to
me.
Because I'm so glad.
No, I have such admiration for your talent. And
I have admiration for you. So.
I've read, I think, probably 9 of your plays.
Oh, wow.
All of them haven't been produced, though, right?
No, all of them have not been
produced.
Yeah,
I mean, there's just more plays that have been sitting there there's still time and space for them to be produced.
It's funny. I actually think, and that was kind of part of my ploy to go into TV, because if you can kind of make it in that space... then theater really is like, okay, what you got? And also, you know, the residency is ending. And not to say that I won't ever produce anything else at Signature, but, you know, I'm being released into the wilds of New York City. And so I'll be able to hopefully place newer things. I also have a commission at the National Theatre in London that I have to finish.
Oh, I love the National Theatre. What's that?
I love them. So it's called Purple is the Color of Mourning. And it's about this Rondice woman whose past comes back to haunt her.
No, she was one of those.
Maybe, maybe not.
I'm just guessing. I like to figure things out. I'm like, oh, she must have been a perpetrator. Or didn't, maybe I read about it, a perpetrator and a victim or something. Maybe somebody's already maybe been talking about it. Yeah, I think somebody maybe already talking yeah, about it. Yeah,
so I didn't have that commission for 8 years because I had sent them all the plays I had wrote, and they were like, we don't want to do none of the stuff you already got. Can you do something new?
For us, because
we want to be special. Thing. And I was like, fuck, you are special. So let me do it.
And what about the theater that you're the artistic director for in Memphis?
Oh, so it was more like an advisory thing that okay. was very short term. I was like, New York Times got that thing all kinds of wrong.
Okay.
So now I'm not really a part of it just because I'm creating so much. And to run a TV show and to run a theater is just impossible because I wasn't there.
Right.
Like I was split between New York and Atlanta.
Yeah. Oh, because that's where you're.
Because yeah, P-Valley is produced down there, but we do post up here, and the writers' room is up here.
Hurt Village was this extraordinarily play. Is there even an archive of it? Did we even get to archive it?
I don't. You know what? I think there is an archive of it.
It was extraordinary. I remember audience members used to be like, "It's just too much." And it's too much. 90 minutes. These people live this 24/7, and you can't yeah. sit with them for 90 minutes.
It was
minutes.
Fascinating. I'm talking to a producer about turning it into a movie.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's interesting how.
It could be a series.
It could be a series. It totally could be a series. Yeah. All or even people, a miniseries.
You want to spend time with those people. You want to know where they're going, what they're yeah. doing, the Absolutely. Neighbors upstairs.
What Toy and Cornbread doing?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. It could be a series.
So many stories. I actually had pitched it as a series okay. for a while. I went, but, you know, I think when I had pitched it, there was just a lot of people were looking for what I call these black aspirational stories.
This yeah. is us.
Yeah. And so even in the premium space, there was kind of like, oh, that's a cool idea, but you know, anything more aspirational. So that always kind of like was tinny on my ear. And so I was like, well, you're not the right place for it, or it's not the right time for it.
Okay.
So I need to either, you know, gather more, you know, whatever fans or respect or whatever, you know, however you want to qualify respect. But yeah, I think in due time I'll be able to circle back to it. But I do feel as though it needs to be in a film or TV format because, you know, the audience in American theater, you know, we know what it is. It tends to be, there's not a lot of us in the theater, and there's not a lot of pole black folk in the theater coming to see shows. And so I think if it's in a format that's more easily accessible, like a TV show, the people that I'm writing for and about will see themselves. And I think the story will resonate more. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want. I want, you know, people to see themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I know you're going to make films because I've already seen
Arkabutla.
Arkabutla. That was the name of that lake.
Yes, a lake in Mississippi.
So I know you're going to do that. What else have you been dreaming up that is not even in the, like, it's just like a little fire that, like, in one day... I might run for president.
Oh, wow. It's funny. All of my kind of dreams are connected to creating stories.
But you've created a lot of stories a lot of roles.
I know.
Probably as many as August Wilson created.
I know, but just in different pockets, yeah.
Right.
I would say I'm very interested in producing other people's work.
I'm ready. You can produce me.
Yeah. I think that is a natural extension of the Katori Hall experience,
right.
Where I see somebody who has great potential and I want to help them harness their power, their creative potential, and to just be a sounding board because it's fucking hard out there.
And Toni Morrison certainly did it. She brought up a whole lot of black writers that nobody would have known about if she didn't, you know, editorially bring them into the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, we have. I mean, I think that's an important piece for anyone, but midwifing the next generation of voices and voices that haven't been heard. Like for me, I'm still like, where are the older black women's stories?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a lot of older black women's stories, yeah. You know?
So I think that's probably the next chapter, but I'm very grateful to have gone through this, you know, baptism by fire of show running, because I just learned so much about just producing, making the right choices, being on set, and crafting stories that have a lot of artistic integrity, but still kind of connect to a lot of different types of people. It's a tricky balance, but.
What would you say is the biggest difference for a writer in crafting your weekly, three things, crafting your, you know, weekly episode mm-hmm. versus writing a play versus a musical, because those are three very distinct kinds of writing.
I think for TV, episodic TV, it's about relying way more on character.
Okay.
Because, like you were saying earlier, you want to spend time with the people. And so this whole thing of, you know, what are they going to do or what's the plot, that doesn't always necessarily have to be at the forefront. You got to want to love the people, the family, the crew, you know, or the protagonist, whoever. I think TV can be very character-based, and you can pull story slowly, like very incrementally, just based off of who a person is, where they work, like who they living with.
Mm-hmm.
Which This Is Us, I think, is a perfect example. That show is going to run forever because mm-hmm. it's based off of a group of people, a family, not even a family, a family that you're rooting for. A play, I think, is a combination of both, where you have to think about character and plot equally because, you know, the container for the show may be 2 hours and maybe 6 hours. But, you know, there is an end. So you have to structure everything around that. And with musicals, I mean, it's different because bio musicals are very different from, I wouldn't say traditional musicals. I think bio musicals are kind of traditional musicals too, where, you know, you have songs that are written specifically for the show versus figuring out how to use songs that were never written, you know, thinking that there was going to be a Broadway show, right. You know, about this woman done, figuring out how they can fit into the narrative and kind of reveal character or move the plot forward in some way. So I would say it's those, even within, you know, musical land, those two different ways of writing, you know, they're completely different.
Did you change lyrics or anything in Tina?
We changed just a little bit. It wasn't a ton. What was crazy was that even though she didn't write any of the songs, only one song, Nudbush, she always picked songs that were very reflective of what she was going through or how she was feeling or how she wanted to feel in terms of wanting to feel empowered. So oddly, it wasn't that much of a chore to figure out where the songs fit. We were very anachronistic in that we picked songs from the 80s and put them in the 60s. Like, some people mad about that, but I'm like, why y'all mad? Like, because what I found very interesting, Let's Stay Together, we put in the first act, you know, during the 60s. She ain't sing that song to the 80s. But y'all mad. See, you don't even know your history. Shut up. You know, I ain't got time for y'all. So it was such an enjoyable experience. It was like one of the greatest collaborations of my life.
Okay, tell us why Tina Turner. Come on, Tina Turner.
Tina. She's just so gracious. And I think it's because I'm very transparent. She very transparent. She a sister girl. You know, they invited me for dinner in Switzerland. And I was like, is the cook black? Because this meat is seasoned real well, Tina. She was laughing. Like, she's just such a lovely person. And for someone to have gone through what she's gone through and to have so much light and love about her, just, you know, like, I want to be like that. But then I don't want to go through what she went through in order to achieve that level of zen. You know what I mean? So I was just very honored that I was even considered, and then, you know, to be picked and given the opportunity to, you know, retell, reframe her story. Just it's it, and I can't believe how beautiful the process was. I was like, God, are you, is this happening? The fact that it was just, I had a really hard birth with my first son. And then my second son, there was just like ease about it. Mm. And there was just like this ease about this particular creative birthing experience.
What was hard about the first real birth, childbirth?
That child was so ready to come out. Was just pounding on my cervix door. Just okay. Like, I want to come out, to the point where he was forcing me to push and I wasn't dilated yet.
Okay.
So, and he's like that till this day. Like, very impatient, very high key, very like, now. And like...
Did you have a vaginal birth?
I had a vaginal birth because, and there was this, I was going to kill her. This nurse came in, she's like, quit pushing or we're going to force you to have a C-section. And I was like, I'm trying. Yeah, it was really bad. And then my doctor came in, and she's this calm woman, just like, we're not going to give you a C-section, but you do need to stop pushing. I was like, but my body wants to push. She's like, oh, you got to control it. Don't push. You're not ready yet. You're not dilated. So
it was a miracle to have had two vaginal births.
Yeah.
That's a miracle in this time when the hospitals are looking for C-sections at 37 weeks because they have more control over it.
They have more control.
So that is a
my
miracle.
My doctor, Dr. Ng and Dr. Elliston, they have this office. It's called 1060 OBGYN, if any of you ladies are interested in checking them out. They are so anti-C-section, and it is rare. And they work at a hospital, Lenox Hill, which has a very high C-section rate.
Really? And Lenox Hill used to be the place where you could go for water births, and midwives used to be there 30 years ago when I was having kids. But
yeah.
Wow,
yeah, it shifted. Yeah, it shifted. And so, I mean, I did. I was trying to do like natural, like no epidural at all. And then I was like, no, give it to me. She was like, are you sure? Are you sure? I'm going to come back in 10 minutes. I was like, But I ended up getting epidural both times. But, you know, vaginal births, I know, it's very rare.
That's congratulations. I feel like when you birth a child, all the forces of the universe are flowing through you. And to deprive a woman of that disempowers her.
Yeah. I remember we talked about it when I was pregnant. This, you know, just how empowering
it's birth empowering. Is. Yeah.
I was like, I'm Superwoman. Y'all can't tell me shit.
It's true.
I just been torn open twice.
Mm-hmm. No, that's some realness. That is some realness right there.
Oh, Lord. Oh, my God. Do I have to leave?
We are grateful that you came. And this is Tanya Pinkins, and I'm with Katori Hall on You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network. Thank you so much, Katori.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals. Edited by Derek Gunther. Music by Anthony Norman. Available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.